Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
There's a consensus among across the political spectrum that we need a stimulus, and we have to make sure that the stimulus is significant enough that it really gives a jolt to the economy.
We are planning within a few days to ask the Congress for legislation to enable the government to undertake public work, thus stimulating directly and indirectly the employment of many others in well-considered projects.
Well, the clip that you could understand there, President-elect Obama from his Jolt Cola news conference yesterday. But is he right that there is such a consensus on the Jolt and Joe approach? We'll get two views in a minute. The other clip was, of course, FDR from his second fireside chat. That was on May 7th, 1933, as everybody is starting to call Obama the new FDR. Now, before the news, we played a tiny piece of President-elect Obama on 60 Minutes from last week, referring to one of the books he's reading right now. We'll talk to the author in a minute, but here is the fuller exchange between Obama and CBS's Steve Croft.
Have you been reading anything about the Depression, anything about FDR?
You know, I have, actually. There's a new book out about FDR's first 100 days. And what you see in FDR that I hope my team can emulate is not always getting it right, but projecting a sense of confidence and a willingness to try things and experiment in order to get people working again. And I think that that's what the American people expect. You know, they're not expecting miracles. I think if you talk to the average person right now, that they would say, well, look, you know, we're having a tough time right now. We've had tough times before. And we don't expect that a new president can snap his fingers and suddenly everything's going to be okay. But what we do expect is that the guy's going to be straight with us. We do expect that he's going to be working really hard for us. We do expect that he's going to be thinking about ordinary Americans and not just the wealthy and the powerful. And we do expect that if something doesn't work, that they're going to try something else until they find something that does. And, you know, that's the kind of common sense approach that I want to take when I take office.
If something doesn't work, we're going to try something else. Experimentation, FDR style. FDR called it bold experimentation back at the beginning of his administration, and it is in again. Of course, it's been in with the Bush people, too. You know, Treasury Secretary Paulson is unveiling his latest version of the bailout plan at this hour. By my count, that's the fifth version since it was originally introduced, and we'll talk about that later in the show. And we have a question for you on our webpage today. Since Bloomberg News estimates the total amount of bailout promises at around $8 trillion now, we have posted the question, what would you do with $8 trillion? What would you do with $8 trillion? Post your answers to WNYC.org, and later on we'll break down exactly what the government is doing with its $8 trillion in financial crisis money. But with us first today, the author of the book that President-elect Obama referred to with Steve Croft there, Newsweek's Jonathan Alter, author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. And he'll compare notes here with Amity Schles, author of another book on FDR called The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. She's a senior fellow in economic history at the Council on Foreign Relations and a Bloomberg News columnist. She's a contrarian on much of this stimulus spending, by the way, and her book is apparently not on the president-elect's night table. But Jonathan and Amity, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Thanks, Brian.
Good morning.
Jonathan, it must be good for your book sales when the global rock star president-elect says he's reading your book. Have you checked your Amazon ranking lately?
It's been doing a lot better than it was before. You know, when the book first came out, it was a bestseller. You know, the paperback sales kind of were a little sluggish there until the president-elect went on 60 Minutes, and then it took off.
Thanks, Barack, says Jonathan
yes.
Alter. Are you seeing specific influences, and I mean specific, yet from the FDR approach that you wrote about in your book, not just sort of this general feeling that, you know, he's been influenced by FDR. How specific can we get on this?
Well, I think you put your finger on it a minute ago. FDR's New Deal was mostly about a spirit of experimentation, what he called bold, persistent experimentation. And in his inaugural address, which is mostly remembered for the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, the lines that were really important, that really represented that speech and his whole approach, were action and action now. And clearly Barack Obama has interpreted that message as being relevant for what he needs to do now. And in other words, even if a particular action doesn't work, you have to keep working the problem and at least dent the problem, even if you you can't solve it right away. It took Roosevelt many years before we came out of the Depression, but things got a lot better, at least, by his taking action, and that did help to restore confidence, even if it didn't solve the problem.
Well, Amity, the president-elect hasn't mentioned reading your book, as far as you know, has he?
No, but it seems to be selling fine.
You're getting a little jolt of Amazon action anyway, just for the historical moment that we're in?
It's done fine all along, Brian.
Good. Is Obama the new FDR for you, Amity, in ways that you like or don't?
I think Obama's more economic and pragmatic than FDR. At least that's what he's shown so far. But
really?
We'll see. We'll see.
In what respects? Be as specific as you can.
Looking a little bit to the private sector for growth. FDR did, too, at times. But the point is, I think generally in our culture, we know more about markets than we did then. So that's going to help us.
This jolt that the president-elect says will be needed for the economy, we're hearing it could be as big as the bailout for the banks, like $700 billion in jobs programs and middle-class tax cuts and some other things. The jolt clip that we played there from Obama yesterday said there's a new consensus around this basic approach. Amity, would you say that you are not part of that consensus?
Well, there are a lot of us who aren't quite part of that consensus. To build big roads and to rebuild bridges is a good thing, and we do have places in the United States where our infrastructure could do with some improvement. The problem is mistaking such construction for the thing that will bring the cure, recovery. When the government spends like that, it feels good and it may alleviate pain, you know, alleviate the crisis just like a transfusion, but it does not necessarily, usually doesn't bring the cure. The cure is usually on the back of the private sector. And that was also true in the 1930s. You go through the 30s and you will see unemployment at 2 in 10 men in 1938 in some months. So that's 9 years into the Depression, and that's hardly a record that the new administration would seek to emulate. They barely ever got below 10% unemployment throughout the 1930s. So, and you can't lay that all off to monetary policy, as some have done. There's a lot of new important work showing it was also government getting in the way. So that's the problem with infrastructure. It's not so bad, but you want to be sure it doesn't preclude the other stuff, which is basically allowing the private sector to do its most important part.
Do you think that that history, Jonathan, is also something that Obama appears to be looking at, not letting whatever public works programs and infrastructure programs and other things that he's planning get in the way of an underlying private sector cure?
Well, Amity's right that Obama understands that, you know, ultimately job creation is in the private sector. But if you look at how we eventually did get out of the Depression, it was through massive public spending in the run-up to World War II. And, you know, I think there is a consensus, as Obama indicated, among both liberal and conservative economists, not all, but most, that large-scale public spending right now is what the doctor ordered. You have to try to prevent a deflationary spiral, because it can be very hard to get out of, as Japan learned in its lost decade and we learned in the 1930s. So the one big difference between now and the Depression is that when Roosevelt came in, There had already been a depression, which, by the way, free market economics in the last part of Hoover's term had not been successful in alleviating. And that depression then kicked off a banking crisis, severe financial crisis. This time we have the reverse, where the financial and banking crisis came first, and we're trying to engage in some CPR here, some put the paddles on the patient, jerk the patient so that he does not go into a full cardiac or arrest, and that this does not turn into a depression. So basically, there's no alternative to what we're doing now, and nobody has yet come forward with any alternative to massive public investment to try to keep things from getting worse.
You know, you mentioned that FDR quote, action and action now. We have that quote from his first inaugural address. Let's hear it.
Small wonder that confidence languishes, for it thrives only on honesty, on honor, on the sacredness of obligations, on faithful protection, and on unselfish performance. Without them, it cannot live. Restoration calls, however, not for changes in ethics alone. This nation is asking for action, and action now.
FDR from 1933. Authors Jonathan Alter and Amity Schley is with us, both with recent books about FDR and the Depression. Amity, for you, how about the idea of bold experimentation? Obama talked about not always getting it right, but being willing to try things like FDR. And looks to me like that's certainly been the Paulson Bush approach, changing the bailout multiple times as they go. They're bringing it back around full circle today to buying out toxic mortgage debt to some degree. But does it give you confidence or does it give you uncertainty to think of all this experimenting and tinkering with the financial system when they're not sure if things will work?
I think there are two points here. The first is listening to John's iteration on history. It's important to point out that these are contentious questions, and we do not agree, many of us do not agree in any number of those points, from whether Hoover was really free market. There's plenty he called laissez-faire a fetish, all the way to whether the war ended the Great Depression. The big question about the Great Depression is, why did it last to the war, not how the war ended it? Economists debate that a lot, too, whether Japan's malaise was a result of monetary entirely or whether it was a result of the kind of policy that we're considering now, which is carefully sorting out, keeping our relationships in Japan's failure to recover. So very, very contentious, Brian. Second question about experimentation. Yes, I, as someone who's emphasized the cost of economic uncertainty in my work, I'm very concerned about the Bush-Paulson record. Looking at it, say, from London, you see them switching just as you count so many times. Not a lot of clarity on that. Certainly not a lot of certainty. Paulson sounded just like FDR when he, or Keynes, to be precise, when he said, well, I changed my mind when I need to be pragmatic. That comes straight out of John Maynard Keynes, the great economic philosopher, but also out of Roosevelt, the pragmatic tradition, which sometimes ignores the cost of scaring markets. Nobody knows what to do because nobody, it's just not clear. What the government is going to do is not predictable. So that is a concern that one would have looking backward, Bush-Paulson, and also looking forward. So far, though, Obama has been less mercurial, and that's one reason markets have rallied.
Jonathan Alter, in your book, you write about the transition period and some of the contention within the transition period. They're walking this delicate line now of Obama not trying to look like a co-president or even a competing president with President Bush, but his original idea to just sit back and let there be one president at a time until January 20th turned out not to work because the markets were just plunging at this kind of power vacuum. So tell us about the transition in 1933.
Well, it was much, much more contentious And you had the outgoing president, Herbert Hoover, and the incoming president, Franklin Roosevelt, who were literally yelling at each other on the night before the inauguration. They had had a series of angry meetings. At one point, Hoover had tried to rope Roosevelt into dealing with the crisis, sent him when he was at the Inner Circle dinner here in New York. It basically practically served him with a subpoena, a letter from the Secret Service, delivered by the Secret Service, that said the financial system of the United States is melting down. You must join me in joint proclamation about this to stop this from happening. But what Hoover wanted Roosevelt to do, as Hoover later admitted to a friend, was to repudiate two-thirds of the so-called New Deal by coming out for things like a gold standard, balanced budget, and these other kinds of things that Roosevelt wanted to move away from. So what Roosevelt did was he pretended that he never got the letter and that his secretary had lost the letter. And he later wrote to Hoover after he'd run out the clock and gotten almost all the way to the inauguration, "I'm sorry I didn't, you know, respond to your earlier letter. The secretary lost it." I later found evidence, Brian, that Roosevelt and his aide, Louis Howe, had used this gambit before in dealing with other things. They just blamed the secretary, who, by the way, was very efficient and would never have actually lost the letter. Nowadays, of course, you know, Hoover's letter would be on Hardball by 5 p.m. There's just simply no way to get away with playing the kinds of games that Roosevelt did to try to run out the clock. But I think his motive was the right one. He didn't want responsibility without authority. And Barack Obama is in the same position precisely. He's now taken some ownership of this economy when he doesn't have all the tools at his disposal for confronting the crisis. And that puts him in a very precarious position in the couple of months we have to go before the inauguration.
Jonathan Alter, author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. Amity Schles, author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. We'll take a couple of phone calls for them in a minute at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Amity, do you think it's worth just stopping for a moment to note how much worse things were when FDR took office than they are today? You were talking about the unemployment rate. At least officially, the unemployment rate is about 8%. We're worried that it might go to 10. I realize that doesn't measure really everybody who's out of work, but in those days it was 25% by the official measure. 10,000 banks failed. There was no FDIC to back up the money. Now there is an FDIC, and banks aren't going out of business left and right, even though there's obviously a financial crisis and we don't know how far yet it's going to go. But in terms of comparing this moment to that moment of transition, should we take some comfort?
I think we should. Where we are right now relative to the Great Depression is in a rainstorm relative to a Katrina. The unemployment, by the way, in that interregnum that John and I both study between Roosevelt's victory and his inauguration, those long months, unemployment went up month by month to 23% to 28%. So there was a huge cost to non-cooperation of the executive, the outgoing and incoming in that period. Yes, it was so much worse. There was no FDIC. There was the banks were themselves very, very weak anyway. There was often no hope of employment soon. It was dark. In fact, many of us feel that notwithstanding a financial crisis, maybe the government is getting too much ammo out now, given where we are, and that there'll be no ammo left should it get a lot worse with those trillions that Bloomberg is already counting being spent. So that's the great question. Are we overreacting or underreacting to what confronts us?
And Amity, I think the great fear of people who, you know, talk about these things, at least how informed they really are, I don't know, is that in a way the government is going to run out of money, run out of firepower, that the depths of the credit default swaps and all that is going to turn out to be so many tens of trillions of dollars that the government actually cannot print enough money to bail out the banks, and then money will be worthless in the United States. Is it not even worth articulating that?
It is worth articulating that. And the crisis beyond the crisis is when foreign investors and governments do pull all their money out of the United States. What we have now is the opposite. Oh, a problem that has a lot to do with the United States is causing a flight to the dollar, or has done recently. It could go the other way if we have a paper that is really worth nothing and lack the strong prospects for growth. So there's a crisis behind the crisis that can happen if we don't find a way back to growth.
Jonathan, you want to get in on that scary scenario?
Well, it is very frightening that we're so dependent on China as our banker, and that you know, where the lines of credit will come from for, say, an auto industry restructuring, we don't really know right now. While it's true that unemployment is not as serious as it was then, the structure of banking is different. The global nature of this is much greater than it was in 1933. You know, Herbert Hoover really thought that it was international trade that was causing all the problems. I think he was wrong about that. He was also paralyzed by his inability to take swift action himself. He didn't want to do anything without Roosevelt. So even though I do blame Roosevelt some for, you know, going off on Vincent Astor's yacht during the transition rather than staying home and confronting the crisis, it's also true that Hoover didn't act. And I think the danger in this situation is not in acting too swiftly, it's in acting too slowly. And so that, you know, there's a reason why the price tag on the stimulus keeps going up, up, up. It's now over $500 billion. You've got to hit it hard. It's like if somebody has a disease, you don't just apply a Band-Aid. You have to move to very aggressive treatment if you want to have hope of curing the disease. So that's the position that we're in right now. But what just is astonishing to me to think about, Brian, is that nobody who is in charge of dealing with this crisis now was even born in 1933. So we are in totally uncharted territory, and all we have to rely on is the intelligence and imagination of our policymakers. Their experience is of limited help in this situation because we haven't been here before.
Though Alan Greenspan, who probably was born in 1933,
helped get
us into this. Robert in Manhattanville, you're on WNYC. Hello. Robert, are you there? Robert, try again. Okay. Phil in Tribeca, you're on WNYC.
Very concerned about the stimulus package in the form it's currently proposed will fail, and the reason for that is people are looking back to the 1930s. The original Keynesian idea was essentially that stimulation works in a fiscal way. That is, that if I build a bridge, the bridge builder gets money, which he then spends on other goods and services, and the money goes round and round through something called the multiplier effect, which we've heard a lot about, and therefore stimulates the economy. The thing is that in the 1930s, that made a lot of sense, because what happened at that time was actually there wasn't that much infrastructure. So the true benefit was not really the money going round and round, but the fact that at the end of the whole thing we had additional bridges and roads and trains and so on and so forth, which really added a lot to our ability to act to be a productive country.
Well, I wouldn't underestimate the needs of the infrastructure today, but Jonathan Alter, do you want to react to Phil?
Well, I agree with you, Brian. There are major infrastructure needs that can help commerce and help rebuild our country. I mean, if you look at our sewer systems, many of them date back 100 years. But infrastructure is only part of it. There's also aid to state and local governments to prevent layoffs and to continue to, you know, invest in things like education, which do pay dividends down the road. It's not like this money would just be, you know, flushed away. If if it is spent properly, and this is a key issue that I think Obama's going to talk about today, to lift it out of politics and have essentially an infrastructure bank or some other process by which we make decisions on how this huge amount of money will be spent.
Amity, how much of that do you agree with?
Only some. What the caller is getting at is the way to improve our GDP per capita, that we all get more dollars and can spend more that are real dollars, is to increase productivity, to make more units per hour at our factory or process the data faster at our computer. And the record of infrastructure is not government infrastructure, and helping that is not that great. In the 1930s, many have argued, including the economist Alexander Field and a very wonderful book by a guy named Nick Taylor just about the Works Progress Administration, that there were a lot of gains then, just as we said, because there was no interstate yet. There was no Eisenhower. There was a lot that needed done in a country that was still states, you know, and we needed to go to the national level. Maybe the marginal gains aren't as great now, so the spillover productivity gains aren't there either. We need some. And maybe, more importantly, all that emphasis on the public sector will crowd out the private sector. And the private sector is the place where the raises come from longer term.
Go ahead.
Brian, I was just going to say, you know, my book is more a story of Franklin Roosevelt and how he confronted the crisis and the various political and personal battles that he went through. So I don't want to get too deep into the economics of this, but if you think about the road that you drove in on today, it was probably built in the New Deal. Now, there have been very, very few major infrastructure projects in all the years since then. So this idea that we don't need things done to relieve traffic, to build rapid transit, mass transit, to convert to a green economy, insulate our homes, all these things are tremendously productive. They help to confront global warming and reduce our dependence on foreign oil. They kill 2, 3, 4 birds with one stone. So I think we need to acknowledge here that these investments in our future are much more productive than, say, investments in Wall Street, paper investments. At least they relate to something physical.
Amity, I'm going to give you the last word here. Robert in Manhattanville, whose line didn't work, wanted to ask about your public back and forth with Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist. What's that about?
I think that a number of things, but one is, how much unemployment was there in the 30s? Was it 11 or 10% some of the time, or was it always more or less above 12? So he was taking a jibe at the numbers I used, which were from the government, and which actually President-elect Obama used and John used just now, so they're pretty official. And I don't know why Dr. Krugman felt the need to attack them, given how official they are, but he did.
All right. Amity Schlaes, syndicated columnist for Bloomberg, visiting fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression, and Jonathan Alter, senior editor and columnist for Newsweek and author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. Always great to have you two on. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, as we've been speaking, Treasury Secretary Paulson has been announcing yet another version of what they're going to do with the bailout money, and it goes back to buying up some of the bad, toxic mortgage debts. So we're going to probe that and see what version 5.0 looks like in a minute.